Tonight on Arena, writer Nancy Harris, director Wayne Jordan team up for the Abbey Theatre production at this year's Dublin Theatre Festival, and Louise Doughty on her new novel, A Bird in Winter. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Casey's handsome new boyfriend, Brett, is the perfect man. He cooks, he writes poetry, and makes romantic suggestions at the drop of the hat. Why are her family suspicious, one might ask? Somewhere Out There You is a new romantic comedy now in rehearsal at the Abbey Theatre. Emer Keating plays Casey, Cameron Cuff is Brett, and the cast includes Kate Stanley Brennan and her father Stephen, playing opposite each other for the first time. The play reunites writer Nancy Harris and director Wayne Jordan. He directed No Romance, Nancy's first play at the Peacock 11 years ago. Delighted that both Nancy and Wayne are with me in studio this evening. Oh, romantic comedy. 11 years later, you're still together, Nancy.
We are. We're a love story.
Well, all stories are love stories.
All stories are love stories.
You quote Robert McLean Wilson at the very top of the at the beginning of your script, you say all stories are love stories.
It's a great opening line to any book, I think. And it's true. Yeah. All stories are love stories.
So did this play then start as a love story? Was it, or did it become one as you started writing it?
I think I was interested in writing a love story because it was something that I hadn't seen a lot of in the theatre, and I'm always interested in what genres do we seem to not explore in theatre?
In the romantic comedy side, I suppose we see lots of tragic and dramatic love stories, but not romantic comedies.
Not romantic comedies. And I love a romantic comedy and I love a love story and I love a tragedy, a Greek tragedy. And it felt like an exciting idea, because rom-coms are always about being loved for yourself. And I was interested in the idea of, well, when we ask someone to love us for ourselves, who are we? Who are we actually asking them to love? Do we know?
Yeah, and that's very interesting in terms of the opening scene of the play, which I must say had me laughing out loud on several occasions. You might explain about the mother who has to visit the principal's office at the beginning of the play, because it's all about role play in many ways, isn't it?
There is something about roles, the roles we play in our lives, and the roles, I suppose, what it's really asking is, in terms of love stories, you know, have we taken love stories from films and from books? And, you know, that's not a new idea. I think they said that the kind of romantic love was invented by the novel or something like this. So, but are we inheriting narratives and then trying to live them out in our lives? And then do we find that we're occupying roles that actually are not authentically us? And so the play is looking at that from a perspective of somebody who a family don't feel should have a boyfriend as handsome and as successful and as wonderful as he is, because they don't see her in her role as kind of matching that, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the starting point of the play.
Yeah, so that is the start. But we do get a wonderful prologue of a young boy dressing up as Cleopatra and his mother having to deal with the fallout from that.
Yeah.
Now, you don't need to go further.
Yeah,
no, you don't need to go any further.
Where is it leading?
But yeah, we don't need to talk about where it's leading. But it is interesting that you get this young guy dressing up at the beginning. It immediately, we're into that idea of people having to play roles to be who they are, in fact.
Well, we're all playing a role. You're playing one now.
Yeah.
And also to have a greater life in a way. Like I think in terms of the child that dresses up, who loves to dress up in many ways, there's something about what is available to us to play, and also what we might want to play, like how we could make our lives more exciting, interesting, how we could increase the scope and scale of them.
Well, I guess in some ways, are we in the world of Oscar Wilde here? You know, the idea that the mask is actually the very thing that will show who we are. He talks about that on many occasions, I think. Had you a sense of being in that world?
I think we are, Nancy? A little bit in that world. I think it's in a lot of that world, but I think something that Wayne was saying there about wanting an epic quality to our relationships, our lives, and how do we reach for that, and can we? You know,
I mean, I think Oscar Wilde is all about self-invention, and I think the play is about the invention of self. The invention of love, that like what, how we create ourselves, or like the possibility of creating yourself.
Well, maybe give us a little bit, just to set up the scenario that we're in. I've touched on the perfect boyfriend, Brett, I mean, when the perfect anything, boyfriend, girlfriend, any friend comes in the door, you got to be shocking careful, don't you?
Yeah.
Give us a little bit of the setup between Casey and Brett and how her parents feel about that.
Well, Casey is...
Casey is a character played by Emer Keating.
And she suffers from some mental health problems, but also she... Just her, you know, they in the, within the roles of the family, she's the unfortunate one, and she's a very successful sister. And she, you know, she invites all her family around one day, and she has this incredibly handsome and impressive boyfriend who writes poetry and who does landscape gardening and who makes quiche and who's American. And she has a fabulous love story about how they met, or a romantic, you know, meet cute, isn't that what you call them?
Yeah, meet cute. But
her family are looking on agog, being like, how did this happen? And this doesn't make any sense. Or, you know, because what they have decided she is or can be is so much smaller than that.
Yeah.
That family dynamic is something that you've explored on many, because not least recently in The Drag, heading into its second season. Is that shot and finished?
It's just wrapped. Yeah.
So that we'll be seeing that, I suppose, at some point soon. But that family dynamic of being forced into playing roles that's who you are. Don't dare step outside that. That's something that interests you, I think, quite a lot.
It is interesting. Well, I think it's the first place that we start to play roles. And then we play them in our marriages, in our jobs, with our children. And
God, I'm getting very depressed now at the thought that is nobody telling the truth?
Well, I think we are. You see, that the truth is it can suit, those roles suit us until suddenly one day they don't. You know, suddenly you find yourself as a mother going, I'm not just a mother. I could, you know, once upon a time I was a dancer. What happened there? Or whatever it is. I was never a dancer. But like, so there's, you know, and it's like, what wakes us up to going, I could be more than I am? What wakes us up to going, my life could be bigger than it is? And how is it bigger? Or are we actually all living very big lives, but we're not giving ourselves the credit for that?
I think there's something all about the pop, but like, because you're saying, you know, it was depressing you, the idea of roles. But I think when you see things like that, the way that we behave in different situations of roles, then you can go, well, what role would I like to play? And how could I?
So it's not necessarily a negative thing that you're playing a role.
No. In a way, I think what we've been, like Nancy's written and what we're working with, is a play about how the initial feeling that you might have in your family of feeling trapped in a role can be turned around, can be like...
Yeah, you can imagine a new role.
How you can imagine a new role, yeah. But and also how challenging it is. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the challenge to everyone else, because the successful sister has always been the successful sister, and suddenly someone else is going, well, look,
how dare you be successful?
Yeah, and it's like, well, hang on, what's happened? The order of the world has shifted. And so what does that mean for her then? And so that's the kind of...
There can only be one main character.
Exactly.
It's only one leading role. Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, pretend that Nancy isn't sitting beside you for just a minute, if you could.
I do often.
If you can play that, if you can play that role for me now, that this is just you and me and you in the studio. You directed Nancy's first play, No Romance, back 11 years ago, I think it said it was at this age. What do you see of the Nancy who wrote, Nancy Harris, who wrote that play? What has become of her? What has developed into the play that you're dealing with now, Somewhere Out There, You?
Oh, well, Somewhere Out There, You started a long time ago. And like, we're developing the play with various, the Abbey for most of that, different people who ran the Abbey, and also with the other kind of support that we
had. So it's been in gestation for quite a long time.
It was the next project that Nancy and I were going to do after that. Now, the play has changed a lot since then. As we have, and the world has. So in a way, we've been like, we kind of, I mean, No Romance was also about romance, and the, you know, so it kind of rolled off that in one way. I think that No Romance was a play that Nancy had finished before I came to it. So I kind of, whereas this play we kind of worked on kind of together in conversation, like, we were in conversation while Nancy was writing over a number of years. But also I think it's probably more formally not inventive, but experimental.
It's
got more conceptually kind of I mean, that makes it sound a bit dry, because actually all those things are quite a lot of fun. And, you know,
yeah, I was going to say, let's talk about the kind of formal inventions that are in there. Mm. And that not only is it inventive, but for you, the director, it's challenging, because we have kind of little black and white movie scenes type of thing. So, which is that kind of hyper-romance in some ways, the black and white. I guess maybe explain how they propel the story along and what you're doing with them in terms of the production.
Well, they're numbers, really, I guess. Like, you know, we enter into Casey's fantasy, you know, and those fantasies are kind of romantic escapades. and so they get, you know, they're kind of staged, and there's some music and this kind of thing. And that is, yeah, challenging, but also a lot of fun. And I would have some kind of form in creating kind of stuff of that, which actually doesn't make them any less kind of I don't want to say difficult, but like hard work to kind of build. But I think we like the play kind of shifts. Like sometimes it's like a thriller, and sometimes it's like a musical. And you know, as Casey moves through the different kind of rooms of not rooms of her mind, but as we move through the different stages of where she is in her relationships. But I think it kind of draws on a lot of kind of theatrical languages and genre languages. I think that's something.
So was that part of what happened then, Nancy, in the conversations? I mean, from what Wayne is saying, what you are saying as well, this has been going on really since No Romance 11 years ago. The idea has been bubbling around. So that playing with the different types of genres, the black and white movies, the big romance of a black and white movie, is that part of what has happened between yourself and Wayne over that decade?
Yeah, I think, well, because of the kind of director Wayne is and the person I know him to be, I feel very safe to be bold in that. Not safe, there's no safety, but I think you always want, as a writer, to offer a challenge or a provocation to a director. And so what I was doing with those stage directions really is saying, here, I'm laying down the here's a challenge.
Yeah.
And he absolutely rose to it. He was never afraid of it. But it is a challenge. And also the play, I, as a writer, while the play is very formally inventive and looking at genre, I always want to be telling a good story, a robust, a muscular story. And that's really important to me. And so I hope that even within all this invention, we're actually still in a very interesting story of who is this guy? Why has this girl brought him home? And what's actually going on?
Yeah, because it's the other thing that struck me. I talked about how the family dynamic is something that interests you. It seems to be there across lots of your work. The other thing that seems to be there, and this is there in The Dry as well, I think we spoke about this with you on the programme at certain points along, that balance between, I mean, Casey has her challenges in her life, it has to be said. You know, Wayne has mentioned the idea of, you know, how robust is her mental health, for example. You seem to be able to mix that kind of dark and difficult question and theme in with the comedy. How important is that, and how do you go about achieving that, I guess? How conscious are you of trying to achieve it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm conscious of it. I think for me, it's always about feeling the truth of a character and being on their side to some extent. Mm. And whatever her problems might be, I feel like she's human. And what's interesting is how people are responding to her rather than the problems that she has. It's the way she's being treated and validated or invalidated is what's interesting. And the fact that everybody in this family feels they have to manage her in some way, and rather than just allowing her to live. And I think that's very interesting to me and interesting to the story and how it plays out.
Explain to me a little bit about it. I mentioned that Stephen Brennan and Kate Brennan Harding are playing opposite. I'm kind of amazed that this is their first time playing opposite each other on stage. What's the dynamic between the two characters there? Or can you tell me that?
Maybe they're theatrical types. Maybe that's the most.
And the characters?
They work together.
They work together, and they're kind of, they run a kind of organisation in the play. They have a bit of a double act, and
yeah. And they're terrific together. They're so much fun to work with.
Stephen was in No Romance.
I was going to say it must be nice to. It's kind of that's another revisit for you in some ways, isn't it?
Yes, and it adds layers to this play as well when people kind of come to see it. I think
in
lots of really great ways, apart from them just being brilliant.
All right, you were sitting looking very nervous at the beginning of it all, Nancy. I said to you, you know, what stage is that of rehearsals? How do you feel at this point in rehearsals? How nerve wracking is it for the writer? You know, a week and a half from getting up on the stage, essentially.
Well, I always enjoy it. Like the cast are incredible, and Wayne's incredible, and watching it is it's, you know, the work that's going on is fascinating to me. It's a very different process to writing.
Yeah.
And I think there's a degree of, you do have to hold your nerve a little bit sometimes, because we're at the moment, it's like a patchwork quilt. We're kind of putting things together, and the play is it's a big ask. So you're kind of going, okay, has that, you know, how does this all fit together now?
Seeing will the stitches hold?
Will the stitches hold?
Oh, I hope they will. Best of luck with it. Somewhere Out There You is the title of the play that writer Nancy Harris and director Wayne Jordan have been speaking to me about. It is at the Abbey Theatre from the 3rd through until the 28th of October. Previews from the 27th of September. And further details on abbeytheatre.ie. Fresh from their best opera win for Handel's Semele at the 2022 Irish Times Theatre Awards, Opera Collective Ireland presents Jonathan Dove's timely, darkly comedic and moving opera, Flight. An overnight success when first performed in 1998, Flight is loosely based on the real-life story of an Iranian refugee stranded at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris for 18 years and his interaction with a group of storm-grounded travellers. The opera unfolds around the different characters who find themselves delayed in the terminal and their interaction with the refugee. Flight has had close on 40 productions to date in Europe, the United States of America and Australia, and I'm delighted to be joined by composer Jonathan Dove on his way to the Irish premiere performance this evening.
It's very exciting.
I was saying to you, Jonathan, just before we came to air, you know, for a contemporary composer, quite often the thing is, let's get my music performed. In the case of this opera, the first performance really did lead to so many others.
It took off, in fact, as you would hope from an opera called Flight. Yeah, but I was so lucky. And of course, when I wrote it, I had no idea how audiences might respond. I wanted to write a comedy, although the story of the refugee is not in itself funny. All of the characters in the airport who are stranded overnight and encounter the refugee have funny things about them. But of course, I didn't know until the first audience was there, whether anyone would laugh or even if anyone would be interested. So it was obviously a huge relief and delight when I discovered that actually audiences did laugh, because I'd really enjoyed setting the line, "Where are your trousers?" And
there are other lines like that. "Do you have English money?" is another one, I think, that comes along. So did you actually, in terms of that libretto, in terms of looking for that comedy, did you almost start from, let's get the jokes into the libretto first of all, and then we'll worry about the music afterwards?
Well, we certainly did the libretto first, and I had a wonderful time working with the playwright April De Angelis, who I wanted to work with because she makes me laugh. And before we discovered this extraordinary story of the Iranian refugee living in Charles de Gaulle Airport, we were talking about classic comedies, operatic comedies like Così fan tutte or The Marriage of Figaro, and of course in Così fan tutte you've got the couple who end up being mismatched, and one of them is really the wrong person. Mm. And some of those sort of plot devices found their way into our airport. So we were kind of geared up for a comedy. And so I think it's an interesting, rather kind of multi-textured piece in that sense, because there's a serious strand to it, and moments of tenderness and surprise.
Quite definitely the situation of the refugee caught in the terminal, stuck in the terminal, literally, and it's almost like a Kafkaesque kind of situation where it's officialdom that won't let him leave and he can't go anywhere else. This, of course, was the story that was told in a slightly other way in the Tom Hanks film, The Terminal.
Yes.
But that came subsequent to your opera,
didn't
it?
That's right. I'd like to think that Spielberg
saw your opera,
one of the performances. And, yes, Well, it is a fascinating predicament. And there is an act of, although there's obviously bureaucracy is involved, there is also an act of bureaucratic mercy because the refugee arrives without papers and we discover that he's done this most desperate thing, which is to stow away in the undercarriage of an aeroplane, which people are still doing and occasionally, extraordinarily survive. They go into a kind of suspended animation at high altitudes. So he survives, but he doesn't have his papers, so they can't let him into the country, but they don't send him back.
Yeah.
They don't send him home. That's the act of mercy. I mean, for the real refugee, obviously that was a very strange experience, and it's quite a dark and complex story to tell. But our refugee uses whatever means he can to try and interest the travellers and see if he can get them to help him.
Yeah.
And to begin with, everyone is on their way somewhere else. You know, they're too busy. They have their own things to do and to worry about. But then stranded overnight during electrical storms, they start to listen to him and they start to wonder whether maybe that magic stone that he was talking about earlier on, perhaps there might be something useful in that.
Yeah, he has this magic stone that I think he has more than one magic stone, perhaps, without giving too much away. But he kind of has this magic stone that he tells people will more or less cure all their ills and all their problems, solve all their problems.
And it's the kind of thing that you don't believe in daylight, but during the night when things are looking dark and difficult, you start to think, well, maybe, I wonder. And so that interaction and that transaction with the refugee gives them more of a reason to try and help him. So then finally, when the refugee natural enemy, the immigration officer, comes on the prowl again. Everyone chips in to try and help him
in this situation. Yeah. And of course, the real life story is that of Mehran Nasseri, as you say. You mentioned this, you know, being stowed away in the undercarriage of an aeroplane. When this opera was written in 1998. Yeah, of course, refugees and of course, emigration and immigration existed in 1998. But there have been real life instances. And in fact, since the opera, I would have thought the situation wasn't there where the unfortunate refugee who fell from the undercarriage of the plane.
Uncannily, in the week in which Flight was being performed in London in 2015, there was a production and during one of those, alongside one of those performances, exactly this thing happened again. And, you know, a stowaway refugee fell to earth from the undercarriage of a plane in London. And you imagine just how desperate you would have to be to do such a thing. I think one thing that's surprising to me is that aspect of the piece actually seems more topical now than it did 25 years ago. I think because obviously we've been thinking much more about refugees. We're very sensitized to them, to their predicament, to their plight. And we face all kinds of challenges in really finding out how to deal with them.
I wondered about that and had it changed in any way the comic tone of the opera. I accept that this refugee, your refugee, is not an exact replica of the real story of Mehram Nasseri. It's not that. It is something more archetypal. But has the tone changed because of the recent experiences in and around refugees?
Well, I think when you watch the opera, you know straight away you're not watching a documentary and that you're in a slightly magical place. It's also, you know, it's an airport that hasn't noticed 9/11 or the changes in security. You know, there's perhaps a certain innocence about it. But I would say perhaps you're more aware of the kind of the mythic aspect of travel and the idea that the way that you may surrender your identity along with your baggage as you enter the departure lounge, and you could be anyone.
Because we get the characters are referred to, the refugee is called the refugee, the controller is called the controller, we have steward and stewardess, we have Minsk man and Minsk woman. I think we may get some of the names along the way, but they kind of have this archetypal feel to them.
That's right, and the Minsk man and Minsk woman are on their way to begin a new life in Minsk. He is a diplomat. At the last minute, she doesn't get on the plane. She's heavily pregnant, and we realise during the night in the airport that she's not really ready to have this baby, and she's looking at this suitcase that used to be full of glamorous things that she took with her, and now it's full of baby things.
Let's listen to the opening of the opera, because I want to specifically pick up on just the skill of the orchestration here at one level, and also what you demand from your controller, who in this case is a female role, a soprano voice, I'm guessing, that we have to hear. Yeah. This is she at the beginning of the opera. Little section there from the opening of Jonathan Dove's opera Flight, which gets its Irish premiere this evening at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. And Jonathan Dove is with me in studio ahead of that particular premiere this evening. Now, I only played the opening minute of the opera there, Jonathan. First thing, the orchestration. Wow. You had done a lot of, I think, community opera previous to this, but this was your first big opera, I suppose, for a big professional opera house. This was Glyndebourne. It was first performed in, and for a big set of professional singers. What did that give you?
Well, gosh, it was like it's a playground or a sweet shop. I had written large scale pieces for mainly amateur performers, and I'd written small scale pieces for professional singers and players. But this was the first time I was let loose on a whole symphony orchestra with a professional cast, and so there was just a joy in thinking, oh, but I can have this and I can do this, and all of those twinkly percussion instruments. They were irresistible. Yeah. And also very helpful in telling a story in a modern environment. An airport is an archetypal modern location, but it's something that Mozart never had to write for. So it's good to be able to use the more modern sounds of the modern symphony orchestra.
And not only that, Claren McFadden was playing the role of the controller in that particular recording that we heard with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Within a minute, and that's not the highest note she has to reach in the opening aria of the piece, but within a minute she's up there in the higher registers of her voice. You really ask a lot of the singers.
But she loves it. She said to me when I first met her that her voice really starts at B, and I thought, well, yeah, but that's like kind of the middle. And she said, oh, no, it was the high B, the top. I'm thinking, goodness, that's where most people think, well, that's enough now.
Yeah.
And that's where she kind of gets going. When I started working in the opera, I told Glyndebourne that I wanted the controller to float above everyone else, like that, because she's up in her control tower, and you wanted the voice also to be high up in the air. And they said, oh, you should definitely meet Claren. And when she sang for me, I was amazed that she was able to sing the top F that the Queen of the Night sings. That note.
Which you can whistle.
But she can sustain it. And I thought, I'd never heard anyone do that. And because it didn't occur to me that this opera might have a life beyond the premiere, I wasn't thinking, oh, but no one else will be able to do it. I just thought, she can do this amazing thing. The world must hear it. So I wrote it in. And fortunately, it turns out now that actually other singers can also do it.
But how does she go towards the end of that aria?
It's the F, top F. So
that's really high.
Yeah, it's virtually illegal.
Yeah. But yet you have asked it. You have asked it of her. When it comes now to this, whatever, as you say, something close to the 40th production of the piece, are you kind of, is it old hat now, or do you still get excited? Do you still get nervous even on the night of a premiere like tonight, the Irish premiere?
I don't get nervous, but I have a really good time, because what I set out to do. Always when I write an opera, I want to write myself a good night out. So I write the thing that I really want to go and hear and go and see. And so probably I enjoy it more than anyone. And so as soon as it starts, I am just really happy. And this opera, particularly because, as I say, it was the first time I'd got to play with some of these toys.
Yeah.
There's a special thrill in it. And I think that you can feel it in the music. You can feel the just the fun I had, the joy I took in writing it. it. So it's always a delight, and it's always different. Every every voice, human voice, is unique. So you never know, and every personalities are so different. And there are many ways of playing. You know, certain events have to happen, but I've seen different characters take on quite different qualities. So that's, it's so interesting.
Quite exciting from your side. Well, listen, I'll let you go and listen to the results of playing with your toys out in the Pavilion Theatre right now. Thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Dove. And performances of Flight will take place at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary tonight and tomorrow night. It then moves on to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway for the 9th of September and the Everyman in Cork on the 12th of September. And you can find out full details of all of those dates and performances on Opera Collective Ireland. Louise Doughty is the author of 10 novels, whose career skyrocketed with the publication of her 7th novel, Apple Tree Yard, an instant bestseller. The novel was adapted for BBC One as a major four-part series starring Emily Watson and Ben Chaplin and cemented Doughty's reputation. A Bird in Winter, her 10th novel, once again features a complex middle-aged female navigating male-dominated corridors of power. This time, the British intelligence service, Bird, is on the run, both from her job and her life and from the ghosts of her past. Delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Louise Doughty. Louise, A Bird in Winter, I'm going to call it a spy novel. Do you mind that? Or do you agree with me?
Well, it's sort of a spy novel, really, isn't it? I mean, she is a spy. But I would say that rather than being a spy novel, it's a novel about a woman who goes on the run and her life, and she happens to be a spy. And I think that's probably the attitude I take with all my characters. The same with Yvonne in Apple Tree Yard. You know, that book was a courtroom drama, but, you know, it was about a woman put on trial. And, Heather Bird, as she's nicknamed, is a very complex character, and in many ways it's a character study, but she is a woman on the run and she's being pursued as well. So yes, it's definitely got some of the tropes of spy fiction too.
And I believe a very early encounter as a reader with the novels of John le Carré may well be responsible for that aspect of this book.
It really has, yes. I first read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold at the age of 14, when I was growing up in a small town in the East Midlands, in the very dead, landlocked centre of England, and in Rutland, no less. And I can remember as a teenager being sprawled on my pink candlewick bedspread, reading this book. And there's a point, not to do any spoilers on John le Carré, but there's a point where the main character realizes something. And the line is something like, with the horrible clarity of a man too long deceived, Lemus realized the whole ghastly trick. And that was the point at which I also realized the whole ghastly trick. And I can just remember my excitement at the idea that if you became a novelist, which was something I had no idea how to be, I'd never met one in my life. They were like, you know, dinosaurs as far as I was concerned. That if you became one of those, you had the power to control what people knew at a certain stage of a story. And I found that incredibly exciting. And I do credit that moment with turning me into a novelist. Although this is my first spy novel. I mean, it's taken me a while to get around to it. As you say, it's novel number 10.
Yeah. And how many 14-year-olds in Rutland were curling up on the bed being excited by the novels of John le Carré? Was there somebody who was responsible for putting such a book into the hands of teenagers in Rutland at that time?
Well, to be honest, there wasn't a great deal else to do in Rutland in the 1970s. And the only place you could go, I mean, there was no Costa or Starbucks, you know, where teenagers get to hang out these days. It was a town, it was Nowhere'sville, sorry, apologies to Rutland, but it wasn't on the way to anywhere. The only place you could go that wasn't home or school was the local library. And if we're giving credit to John le Carré, I've got to credit my local library. It was a really unprepossessing red brick, one-story building in the centre of town. But for me, it was a cornucopia. And it's one of the few places I was allowed to go on my own. It's one of the few places you could go when it was cold in winter, other than the bus shelter. And you could go and you could sit there for hours. And I started off there discovering, you know, fantasy like Ursula Le Guin or Arthur C. Clarke and science fiction, and then read my way through adventures and spy novels and really read anything I could get my hands on. It's amazing, really, just how many novelists I know of my age, where we were the great beneficiaries of public libraries, and that's where we discovered ourselves and discovered our future selves.
Yeah, and so much debate around in recent times about, you know, the funding of public libraries and keeping them in existence. You've just done a great service to the whole idea of the public library in what you've just said.
They're essential.
Yeah, totally essential for those. You know, the books are all there. It doesn't matter if it's a dull red brick building. Everything inside is colourful and imaginative.
Any building, as long as it's open, yes.
And the other side of it, you touched there on this idea of, you know, reading the John le Carré at 14 was one of the things that was responsible for maybe putting the idea of being a novelist in your mind, and this idea that you could hook the reader along and perhaps trick them, or, you know, turn the tables halfway through the book or whatever point you wanted. What about the beginning of the book? Because it really strikes me, or struck me, about the beginning of A Bird in Winter. We start out with, well, maybe you'd explain what happens in that opening kind of scene, because it really sets a mystery in front of our eyes.
It does, yes. And a lot of my novels in recent years have started with opening scenes where there's a character in a situation and you're invited to wonder what the heck is going on. And it's also true of A Bird in Winter. We first meet Bird. She's in a meeting in a really unprepossessing tower block in downtown Birmingham. And she's in a conference room sitting around one of those glass-top tables with her boss and her colleagues, with papers on the table in front of them and coffee and pastries. And at first you might think it's any other sort of business meeting. And then something gets said in the meeting. Something's just been said as we come into the scene. And she rises up from her seat, and she's thinking, calculating, it's no more than 30 paces to the lift. And she has to get out of the building. She has to get out fast. And from that point, she goes on the run. She goes and picks up a holdall that she has already hidden in a shop. She goes to Birmingham New Street Station, gets on a train before it leaves, changes her appearance, adopts a disguise, gets off the train, gets on another one. And we know that she's running for her life, but we don't know why.
Yeah,
and really, for the first part of the book, we don't understand why.
I know. This is one of the things I'm doing, and I'm glad you're talking about playing tricks, because when I read that opening section, I went, I must have missed something. And I went back. No, there was. They didn't. They haven't told me what was said. No, I don't know why. No, she's in a hurry to get out of this room. I don't know why. And then I realised, oh yeah, Louise Doughty doesn't want me to go back and read that 44 times. She wants me to keep reading. You really want the reader to follow the journey with you. Do you know, or did you know at the starting point where the journey was going, or were you like the rest of us following Bird or Heather to find out what was going on?
Oh, I'm absolutely as ignorant as the reader when I'm doing the first draft. I mean, I go on the journey myself. You know, I physically went on the journey myself, but I'm also going on the journey of discovery myself. I don't really know what's happening. And what that normally means is that the first draft is a real mess, because then once I've worked it out for myself, what's actually happening, I then have to go back to the beginning and I have to feed in some clues so that the reader won't feel cheated. Because, you know, there's nothing worse than watching a TV program or reading a book and you go, oh, well, I didn't see that coming because it wasn't coming. You know, the novelist really has to do their job. And there's always a lot of rewriting once I've worked things out for myself. But I really do have to write the first draft to work it out for myself. When I begin a novel, I throw myself in at the deep end and I have not got a Scooby. And that's exactly what happened with this book.
You talked there about doing the journey, because Bird does go off, and you described a little bit of us, you know, Birmingham onto the train and off on several other trains. She makes her way up to the very top of she's up in Scotland and goes further as well, beyond that as well, towards the end of the novel. Talk to me a little bit about doing that journey Because what strikes me about Bird's situation was how isolated she was in the doing of that journey. How isolated did you feel, and how did that play into the book?
Yes, I mean, it really did play into the book. I'd already been to Norway and Iceland before the pandemic, and I knew that I wanted the book to end in Iceland. But the bit I hadn't done was the journey from Birmingham up to Orkney. And I did the journey myself. I took a couple of weeks. I stayed one night at a time in various guest houses, some of which the guest houses in the novel had drawn on. And I did it on my own with a rucksack on my back and a beanie hat. And the first thing I discovered when I researched is that if you're going on the run, you really can't use a car, because thanks to automatic number plate recognition, you won't get 10 miles down the road. So Bird's journey had to be on trains, buses, and on foot, hiking, ferries, and all the rest of it. So I did her journey. I started in Birmingham. I got the train up to Glasgow, and then over to the Western Isles, over to a little village called Plockton, which I really fell for, on the west coast of Scotland. And I decided a crucial scene was going to be set there. And then across the country to Inverness, and then up to Thurso at the very, very northern reaches of the British mainland, and over to Orkney. And there were some times when I was going hiking on my own, and I was in areas with no phone signal, and I have to say it was pretty creepy. I mean, the idea of writing scenes where Bird fears for her life, that was not difficult.
Well, in fact, maybe you might,
or adventurous person.
Yeah, you might read a little section, because I wondered how much of this was Louise Doughty maybe experiencing this as well as Bird, the character, experiencing it. You've chosen a little section. We're up around Thurso at this point, actually, I think, in the novel, aren't we? The section that you're going to read for us.
Yes, so this section is set in Thurso, which is the northernmost reaches of the British island. And it's the next day, Bird is due to get the ferry to Orkney, and that will be her finally leaving the mainland behind. She's going to go on to Orkney, then Shetland, then she's going to cross illegally, the North Sea illegally, on a yacht and get into Norway. But she's got there, and this actually happened to me. I got a bus to Thurso, and I was dropped off, and it was pitch dark, and all my fellow passengers melted away. It's a very small town, and there's just nobody on the streets, and I needed to find the guest house where I was staying that night, and it was very spooky, and I went looking for it, and I took a wrong turning down a driveway and realized I was in somebody's front garden, and there was a dog in the house barking and a security light, and I had to back out very quickly. So that's where this scene comes from. Right. And let's just say that this precedes a very, very dark thing that happens in the book. You know, it's a Doughty novel. Dark things happen. So this is Bird in Thurso after nightfall. I stop where I am. The night is dark. The wind blows. The street is empty. Should I go back to find the guest house, or press on and find a sheltered spot to sleep rough out of town? I can head to the ferry terminal at first light, after all. I'm longing for a bed, but some instinct is making me feel unwilling to turn and head back into town. Have I let that barking dog spook me? Something is wrong. On my right, a stone wall stands between me and the sea, which is lost in the darkness, invisible. I can hear the waves crashing onto a pebble beach, a whooshing sound followed by a low rumble as the retreating breakers drag pebbles and stones back into the water. On the left, the buildings have thinned to almost nothing. There are a few low, square houses set back from the road. Ahead of me, the road is swallowed by the night. I turn and look behind me. All is darkness. Shadows. Around 100 yards back, there is a black vertical stripe of a lamppost with a small contained pool of light at its foot. The wind blows and the waves crash and I know I have no alternative but to keep walking and see if there is a place ahead where the town gives way to fields, because if I stay far enough ahead, it will be so dark out there I will be able to hide. There's no doubt about it. I feel it in my bones. I am being followed.
Louise Doughty, you really like frightening us. Were you that? You must have been that afraid in that moment, because that's what comes across in that page.
I was pretty spooked that evening, I can tell you. I mean, to be honest, there were lots of places in that journey I was pretty spooked. And, you know, Heather is a competent person. Yeah. You know, she's much more physically competent than I am. And the hard bit was imagining her having a certain amount of bravery and physical competence. I'm not sure I would have done in that situation.
One other thing that she does, I wondered if you did this yourself, she is in the world of, we are in the world of the spy novel, if you like, in that she keeps changing. She changes her hair, she puts on different hats, she changes her appearance so that she can become somebody else. Did you do any of that?
No, I didn't go quite that far. Although I have to say, when you're travelling for 2 weeks with only the stuff you can get in the rucksack, you're pretty limited. Yeah. And there certainly weren't any smart outfits. I did do as much research as you can do into the world of spying. But of course, what's interesting is when it comes to something like tradecraft, is they're not allowed to tell you anything.
Of course.
I mean, I did have some help from a couple of people who I'm not allowed to name, and I'm not allowed to tell you what organization they work for either. But the great thing about writing a spy novel is nobody can contradict you, because it's all secret.
One final thing I would like to ask you just before we finish up, because it's an important aspect of the book, the fact that Bird was a member of the Women's Royal Army Corps in the 1970s, 80s, I suppose, we're looking at here. It wasn't a good place for a woman to be, let's face it.
It really wasn't. I mean, back then, you know, women couldn't go to Sandhurst. They couldn't bear arms. You know, they were actually taught, and I found out, they were taught flower arranging so that they could make the mess room nice for the officers. And, you know, Bird is a woman who wants to make a contribution, and she's very frustrated. And she does end up leaving the army under something of a cloud, shall we say. And that's how she ends up in the Secret Services. She's a woman who all her life has been underestimated, and to a certain extent has underestimated herself. And in the pages of my book, she's really got to discover what she's got inside of her to survive.
That's great. Listen, thanks a million for that, Louise. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Fascinating stuff indeed.
It's been lovely to speak to you too. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Louise Doughty there, and her novel A Bird in Winter is out now, published by Faber and Faber. Earlier on this evening, I played you a little bit of this. Yes, you all recognise it as the Brendan Voyage, and Sean Davey as the composer. Certainly Mary Ryder in Dublin 8 recognise it as such, and she will be heading to Saturday night's concert featuring the Piatti Quartet and others as part of Music in Monkstown. The festival begins this weekend, and that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy research. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.